Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. This week's show is going to be off the charts. I'm really excited. We have three guests with us today. We're going to be joined by our legal expert, Dominic Rossetti, who's going to be talking to us about how sexual assault is handled on college campuses. Then we're going to have Rachel from Lou Tours coming to talk to us about toilet dating. We're also going to be joined by Hannah, who's a military wife, to talk about how being in the military or being a military spouse affects marriage and family relationships. I'm really excited. Let's begin with our dating news of the week and then follow up by our Hollywood report. All right, y'all. This week, I was reading a lot about business and pleasure. You guys know how much I like the movie Working Girl. It's one of my favorite movies with Harrison Ford, and a lot of it relates to how individuals who are in the workplace together can date and interact. And I saw this interesting article about women and men meeting each other in the workplace and at networking events. So we know that 40% of people in the United States say that they have dated a colleague. This seems really high to me, but at the same time, it makes sense. You spend a lot of time at work. People are delaying marriage and family following education and moving out of the house. So it would make sense that you would meet somebody at work. But what happens if you meet at networking events? At work, the relationship is sort of clear. Your colleagues, and sometimes there are policies at your workplace regarding how you should be behaving among colleagues. But at networking events, it's not so clear. Or as Robin Thicke likes to say, the lines are a little blurred. We've got blurred lines, people. So how do you send a right message that you're professional, but at the same time, maybe interested? These are things that we need to think about. I think it affects what you wear. If you're going out to networking events and you're wearing something that's a little skimpy or scandalous, you might be sending a different message than you're there to network. At the same time, if you're in a conversation with somebody and it's going to a place that's more romantic than you might like, you might want to pull in the reins a little bit and say, okay, let's focus back on the conversation at hand about what we're talking about with our business. So these are things to think about because we need to think about mixing business with pleasure. As Melanie Griffith's character said in Working Girl, she had a brain for business and a bod for sin. Ladies, you want to make sure that you have both the brain for business and the bod for sin as well. Okay, stranger danger. I'm always talking about being smart and being safe on dates. And apparently, a lot of young women are thinking the same way as I am. Good job, ladies. At Roosevelt University, there was a study conducted recently by two psychology professors interviewing women who were students between the ages of 18 and 36. So there's a lot of age range here. These women have a lot of different life experiences with dating. And their findings are that women who are older take more precautions than women who are younger. Obviously, a little bit older, a little bit wiser. But at the same time, they're finding something consistent across age groups among these women. They're finding that when women are meeting somebody for the first time online, they're more likely to take precautions than if they just meet him in person. This makes a lot of sense. I know I talk about Manti Te'o all the time, and this guy just can't catch a break from me. But you never know who's on the other side of the computer screen. And I think Manti Te'o is a really great example of that. Granted, Manti Te'o's correspondent was not somebody who was dangerous to him physically, but he certainly put a damper on his football career. So these are all things to think about, and I'm glad that women are being smart and dating safe. Okay, I got a lot of traction this week on Hook Up with Dr. Jess for my post about the demographics of porn. Yes, I'm not kidding you. There are demographers who study porn. It's quite interesting, trust me. So Pornhub put out a lot of data a couple weeks ago related to who's using their porn sites, where they're located, and what type of porn they're looking at. According to Pornhub, the sites that have the longest length of views on the site are people who live in Mississippi, Hawaii, and other states in the South, like Arkansas. This is kind of interesting. In the Northeast, people spend far fewer time on adult sites. The longest period of time that most people spend on sites is around 12 minutes or so. So let's put it this way. The East Coast people know how to get the job done fast. I'm an East Coaster. Let's put it that way. But what's more interesting than just the length of time that they're on the site is what they're looking at. And I'm sure you're wondering, as was I, how do different people in different states look at porn, and what exactly are they looking at? So people in California, where I am in Los Angeles, are more likely to look at Asian porn. In Texas, they're more likely to look at teen porn. In Pennsylvania, where I grew up, they're looking at porn from college students. And in the South, in Georgia, they're looking at porn of African Americans, or ebony porn, as they call it. So this was really interesting to me. What are people looking at? We know that answer, but my question now is, who's actually online? So I went to do a little bit of looking into this. 75% of men between the ages of 18 and 24 sign on to an adult dating site or an adult porn site within a month period. 1 in 3 users of an adult site are women. I was shocked to learn this. And the state with the highest rate of subscribers to an adult site, you're never going to guess. It's Utah. Who would have known? The home of the Mormons is also the home of porn subscribers. I would have never guessed this. But apparently this is the case. Porn knows no demographic group or no boundary. I've also identified the next Craigslist killer this week. No, no violent threats, but there's this guy on Craigslist who posted an advertisement seeking a woman, and I can't even begin to tell you the psychological issues and pathologies this person must have. He posted a 28-question FAQ, or frequently asked questions list, to women who are prospective mates or prospective applicants to become his mate. According to this advertisement, the man is seeking a woman who must be worthy, deserving, and reciprocate. I'm not exactly sure how this man is defining worthy. I'm really actually kind of scared how he does define it, and hope that no women are actually applying to him. He's looking for a woman who is between the ages of 18 and 27, but I think he's willing to consider applicants, because if you're 27 or older, he asks you to submit some information to him about what you've been doing for the past few years. So I guess if you're 27 years old, you haven't really expired. Or maybe not to him. Some of the more interesting FAQs he asked were, how much do you expect to be spoiled? I was really, really, really surprised by this. I mean, the things that he was willing to ask, I was really kind of scared. But he makes all of these guarantees that he's going to be this great guy and that he's better than 99% of men out there. I'm not really sure if he can deliver on this. And frankly, I don't really want to know. But my bigger question is, do the women come with a guarantee? And does he get to kick the tires too, but while he's at it? All right, y'all. That's my dating news of the week. I'm going to play some music and then be back with the Hollywood Report. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just had our dating news of the week, and now we're going to get into our Hollywood Report. Okay, Girls Gone Wild creator Joe Francis is now going to be going to a big house. Hopefully one with lots of men rather than girls going wild, because he certainly deserves it. About 2 years ago, Joe was charged with assault. A woman came to his house. Well, excuse me, actually 3 women came to his house. He had them over for, I guess, a play date. And he proceeded to assault one of them. He grabbed her hair, he threw her to the ground, and he crashed her head into it. Then, after he was done, he threatened her and told her that she was not allowed to call the police. He was charged with assault, obviously, and sentenced to 270 days probation. Oh, excuse me, 270 days in jail and 3 years probation. He also has to go to therapy, and he has to take anger management classes. Gosh, I hope so. So last week we talked about Michael Douglas, and I told you how much I love Michael Douglas and how he's my favorite actor. But last week we thought he was staying together with Catherine Zeta-Jones. Today that might not be the case. Apparently, after 13 years of marriage, Michael and Catherine are calling it quits, or at least separating for the time. According to friends, her bipolar disorder and his recent confessions regarding HPV and his cancer have sort of put a strain on their marriage. So now the two are trying to work it out and hopefully can get back together. I hope so, because I don't want this to affect Michael's film schedule. All right. I think we all know that I have to talk a little bit about the VMAs. Miley Cyrus's performance was blurry, to say the least. And the lines, I don't know if they're there anymore, because they're definitely not blurry. Miley Cyrus's performance on Sunday night was, to say the least, explicit. I would like to tell you, Miley, I don't want to slut shame you. That's the last thing I want to do. And hook up with Dr. Jess, I like to empower women. At the same time, you should know, Michael Jackson did the crotch grab a lot better than you did. And that thing with the fingers, I just don't get it. What were you thinking? This obviously Disney star turned femme fatale needs some serious psychiatric help. I didn't understand what was going on with the tongue thing either. Dr. Ruth said that people are now talking about Miley Cyrus and calling oral sex Miley because of how much she had to use her tongue. Dr. Ruth is now calling it the Smiley. So, in the vein of Dr. Ruth, we're going to go with Miley Smiley on Hook Up with Dr. Jess. All right, lovers and friends, that's the Hollywood Report. We're going to play a little bit of music and then get right back. Don't go anywhere. Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just did our Hollywood Report, and now we're back with Rachel Erickson, who is the head of Lou Tours, which is offering new speed dating events in toilet areas, or I don't know if we want to call them toilet areas, but in bathrooms, essentially, in the greater London area. And I was really fascinated by this. So, Rachel, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So, Rachel, tell me a little about this. What exactly is involved in this loo, or bathroom, at least, as we say in the U.S., tour in Britain, in this speed dating event? I just don't get it. Please enlighten us.
Right. So it all started back in January when I started doing toilet tours, actually not with any dating element, which is a whole other story. But when I moved to London, I had an obsession with free public bathrooms because they charge quite a lot here.
Oh, wow.
So new tours became they do, and they'll be about 30 to 50 pence for a lot of them. But Lou Tours became a thing, and then I sort of jokingly tweeted at a company called doingsomething.co.uk and said, hey, do you want to send any couples along on my tours? And they came back at me with, well, why don't you do a singles night? And so we did, and they pitched it to the press, and that sort of went international. The press christened it toilet dating, which I think is hysterical.
Yeah.
But basically, we get a group of about 20 singles, and we do what would be my normal toilet tour, looking at interesting historical and modern toilets. But on the date nights, there's quite a bit more drinking and socializing.
I would imagine so. I mean, Rachel, I must be honest with you. I always say I'll give everything a whirl, but maybe I should say I'll give this a swirl. But I'm just really not sure. How does it work? Like you said, drinking. I mean, do people want to really open up a bottle of Riesling while they're standing over a toilet? It just doesn't seem very sanitary.
Well, we do not actually drink in the toilets mostly.
Okay, good.
So one exception is if you're familiar with London, London has quite a lot of Victorian underground toilets, a lot of which have been closed down as toilets. But there's a very cool cocktail bar that's in a former gentleman's toilet, which used to be quite famous because it was the toilet that Oscar Wilde and Joe Orton and John Gielgud and quite a lot of famous actor types have been to frequent looking for lives. But now it's been turned into quite a posh cocktail cabaret bar called the Cellar Door. So we do actually have a drink in that toilet.
Lovely. So you refer to it as a toilet rather than a bathroom.
It's a linguistic thing, actually. I'm American as well, and I've been in Britain long enough to adjust to toilet meaning what we would call bathroom in the U.S.
Got it. So,
toilet is the whole room.
Got it. How many people can you fit in this room? I mean, I think about the bathrooms in most places, especially like different cabaret bars. I mean, there aren't really cabaret bars in the U.S., but I'm thinking about different bars or venues. How many people are you accommodating in these places?
Cellar Door can take up to about 50, so it's quite intimate. And they managed to get 50 people in there, plus performers, which is quite incredible for that small space.
That is pretty incredible. What happens if someone really wants to go to the bathroom?
Well, the nice thing about the Louvre tour is there are plentiful toilet breaks, as opposed to most tours where you have to have the bathroom break midway. We actually have them as many times as people need.
Oh, good. It's all abundant. For me, that would be great, because I always have to go to the bathroom. But what happens if a patron from, like, the cabaret bar, for example, wanted to use the toilets? Does the facility shut down the toilet for the night?
There are separate toilets. So the whole building was once a gentleman's public toilet. Now they've got two cubicles in the back, which are quite cool in and of themselves. Because they actually have doors that are made of something called smart glass, so they're see-through until you lock them.
Perfect.
Which is brilliant, seeing people's responses going up to them and going, the toilet door is clear, what do I do with this?
Yeah, no, that raises a lot of issues socially. Speaking of socially, how is the interaction between these people? I mean, it's a singles event, you're meeting people, but you're doing something pretty intimate together. You're going to the bathroom together. I normally don't go to the bathroom in front of someone I date for about 9 months to a year. You know, it takes some time, but I'm pretty open.
Just to set the record straight, we don't actually go to the bathroom in front of each other. People can do that in their own time if they want. But it's quite fun, actually. It's interesting because doing something, the dating company's motto is taking the awkward out of dating. And I feel like I'm kind of putting it back in again.
Yes.
But really, I think it's quite fun because despite bathrooms, toilets being kind of a taboo subject, it's something that everybody has in common. So even if you have nothing else in common with your date, you're bound to have that. And actually, in my months of doing the tour, I found that as soon as people know what I do, they'll really open up, and everybody has a bathroom story or a toilet story that they want to share.
Oh, I'll share mine on the air right now because it's related to dating. And then I want yours, Rachel. Okay, so this is my toilet story. I was 17 years old. I was visiting my boyfriend's family, and we had just gone to a big family event together, and then we went out to dinner, and we were at a restaurant, and I walked into the men's room, and his father was standing at the urinal. I was so mortified. I mean, I still remember it to this day, being mortified. I didn't see anything, thank God, but I'm still mortified. What's your story?
I have so many stories now. I don't know if I have any quite that awkward. I've definitely walked in on people. But actually, my latest kind of funny moment was because I do the tour and I get people's stories. I get interesting emails sometimes. But just the other day, this guy emailed me like an essay on how frustrated he is by finding public toilets in London. And he asked me all these questions, including, you pee outside? I don't know how to respond to this.
Do you pee outside? I would say, when I have to, when nature calls. That's just right, when nature calls. That's appropriate.
There's actually a festival toilet company called When Nature Calls in the UK that does luxury festival toilets.
Oh, lovely. Yeah. No, I mean, this isn't related to dating, but it sort of is. I guess my most recent ex had a toilet that it was actually like it sprayed you or like a bidet. And I was terrified when I first started to use it.
Do you want to know how they found the angle for the spray?
Please share that with our listeners.
So I have read, and I presume it's true because it was a fairly prestigious academic who wrote about it, that the company that makes the toilet has all 300 of their employees sit on the toilet and mark the perfect position for the spray, and then they took the average. So it's at a 43-degree angle, apparently, is the best spray.
Well, that's good. As a 5'1" woman, I might want it to be about 45 or 46, but we'll go with 43. I'll accept that.
There's a competitor company that does it at 70. It's highly controversial.
Oh, wow. That's pretty interesting. But, so, I know you've gotten a lot of international attention. I mean, you're on a radio show in L.A., but how has it been received by customers? I mean, are you going to have another tour soon?
We are. Our next one is September 6th, and it's actually very close to sold out, which is quite exciting.
Yes, wonderful.
All the women can piss on that. And we've got just a couple places for men. So any single gentleman in London listening right now, do you come along?
I have a couple friends in London on Facebook. I will make sure I give them a shout out. I'm sure they would love that.
That would be brilliant. You should come if you're ever in London.
Oh, I definitely will. You have no idea.
Speaking of.
I don't believe there is this type of event in LA. I think that there should be. I actually have some friends of mine who work for a dating event company, and I will talk to them about having our next date event be toilet dating. We will definitely try to work with you on this.
Brilliant. You'll have to help recommend.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Rachel, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been fun.
All right. Bye-bye. All right, lovers and friends, that was Rachel Erickson with us today talking to us about loo dating or loo tours or toilet dating or toilet speed dating. Whatever you want to call it, it's dating in a toilet. We're going to play some music and then come right back with Hannah to talk with us about the lives of military wives. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess. Your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. This past week, I've been doing a lot of reading about military families, and I wanted to share the story regarding marriage within the military and how that works, because we don't really think about alternative styles of marriage and how marriages can look different. We think of a nuclear family where one in two people live in the same house at all times, but most households are not like that, and I wanted to talk about a new, unique form of marriage in that regard. So I'm here tonight with Hannah, who is married to a man in the military, and here to share with us a bit about their stories. Welcome, Hannah.
Hi, thanks.
Thank you so much for being here tonight. I really, really appreciate it.
I'd love to get the word out there. A lot of people don't know exactly what it's like to be married to someone in the military, so I'm more than happy to get, you know, some new, you know, sights on that matter.
Absolutely. From what I understand, you and your husband met prior to him entering the military. Isn't that correct?
Yes, we were together for about 2.5 years before he left for basic training.
Wow, that's a long time to be with somebody. Did he have aspirations to be in the military prior to beginning your relationship?
He'd always had it as an idea, but when we would always talk about it, it was, oh, you know, that's not something that I would really think about doing right away. He really wanted to be a New York City police officer, but as our relationship progressed, you know, he realized that wasn't going to happen. And, you know, we really started looking more into the military idea, the Army, and it just ended up happening.
Absolutely. So you went into this relationship understanding that at a bare minimum, he would try to enter a career that would involve considerable risk to his physical well-being, whether it be the military or the police force.
Yes, I did.
Absolutely. So when he came to you and said that I'm considering joining the Army, what was your reaction?
Honestly, when he first told me, I freaked out. I was scared. I couldn't stop crying for like 3 days. I didn't know what to do. I wasn't sure if I was going to be able to handle it. It was really tough. It was a tough few days, but, you know, we talked about it a lot, and it was, okay, well, obviously, you know, I've been with him for 2 years. I really love him. I'm willing to make this work.
Absolutely. So how did this affect your basic marital planning decisions, your family planning decisions, etc.?
Well, it's kind of hard because especially, you know, at the moment, it's really kind of hard to work things out. I mean, we haven't even been married for a year yet. Mm-hmm. And so I moved out here in January. We got married last September. So as far as, you know, the marriage goes, you know, if there's, you know, you have to figure out the other person. It's figuring out, you know, the whole living together thing. How do we work as a couple, you know, when we're together all the time? Mm-hmm. And with the military there, you know, it's kind of like, okay, we'll have to factor that into the whole thing as well. And then, you know, people always ask, well, when are you going to have kids? You know, you're married, that mm-hmm. comes next, and it's a big factor in deciding when and if you're going to have kids.
Oh, absolutely. And from things that you've told me before, it seems as though many individuals who are in your husband's unit have children already.
Oh, yes. Most of the people in his unit have kids already. There's only a handful of us who are either pregnant or
there's a lot of pressure without being a lot of pressure. I mean, none of them are, you know, saying, oh, you really should go and have kids. But at the same time, just based on military culture, there is a decent amount of pressure to, you know, kind of get married and have kids, like, right away.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What's caused you to decide to forego having children immediately?
Well, for us, you know, I'm only 23. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be 24 in November. He's only 26. We decided that we didn't want to have kids right away. We wanted to, you know, settle into getting married, figure that out for a little bit, and then enjoy it for a while, because everybody says the first year of marriage is the hardest. And then my mom always sat me down, and she's like, everybody says the first year of marriage is the hardest. Wait till you have kids. It changes everything. So we wanted to enjoy that, you know, being married for a while. And plus, he's going to be deploying soon, and we didn't want to, you know, throw a kid into the mix right away or right before he deploys.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. I especially understand from what I've been told by other people who are in relationships and have recently married, or from what I've read and researched, that the first year of marriage is very hard because, as you said before, you're learning about living with someone else and compromising and being married to someone else. It's a completely and totally different world and mindset.
Oh, yeah.
What do you think is the most difficult aspect of being the wife of somebody who's serving in the military?
Well, there's a couple things. One of the most difficult aspects is, you know, the fraternization rules. There's a lot of rules around, you know, who you can and can't hang out with. For example, my husband is only a private first class, which is an E3 in the Army. We're not allowed to hang out with anybody, really. We're not supposed to be hanging out with anybody above an E4. We do have friends who are E5s, but, you know, we have to be really careful about how we hang out with them, what goes on, and even normally speaking, we wouldn't be allowed to do that. However, at the same time, they always encourage the wives to hang out together. Oh, you should get together, you should become friends, you know. But when the wives are the only ones that can hang out, it can make things kind of awkward and kind of difficult, because then it's like, well, you know, we can hang out, but our husbands can't be friends.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, how would you go to... So, theoretically, you and your husband couldn't go have dinner and go to a movie with another couple if the other couple's husband was an E5 or the wife was an
E5? Exactly. That's the thing, you know, and definitely not, you know, we couldn't go out and say, hey, we're going to go out to dinner and then we're going to go out for a few drinks. That's way frowned upon. That's a lot of trouble that you can get into in those types of situations.
Very interesting. Do you know what the basis for that rule is?
It's because, especially with, you know, superior officers and stuff like that, they don't want you getting too close because, say, for instance, you do get into a combat situation and, you know, the senior officer says to, you know, the enlisted, he says, hey, I need you to go and, you know, charge that hill and take it, and it's quite possible that you won't come back. They can be like, well, I thought we were friends. Why are you asking me to do this? So that's the big basis behind that. If you don't want to get too close, because then it's harder to follow certain orders from those people if you're too much buddy.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. At the same time, I guess, I mean, maybe it's just hard for me to think of any type of distance knowing that you're putting someone in harm's way, but that rule does make a great deal of sense logically, because it does maintain this distance that is definitely necessary in a combat situation that you said.
It's kind of the same as, you know, if you work in a retail store or a company or something, you know, they generally don't like you hanging out with your managers, for example. If you're a sales associate, they say, well, you know, you should be careful about hanging out with your managers and stuff like that.
Absolutely. So I'm curious about, given that you said that they're encouraging wives to hang out and become associated, what types of support does the military provide to spouses during and following the deployment of their own spouse?
There are a ton of resources out there nowadays. There's something called ACS, which is Army Community Services, and they, you know, have job help. They can help you get into school. They can help you around post. Like, when I first got out here, when I first moved on to post, I had no idea what I was doing. I had no idea where anything was. And I just kind of went over and I'm like, hey, I'm new at this. I need to, you know, get into the system over at the health center. I need to figure out how to get reimbursed for my move out here. How do I do all this stuff? And then it kind of sat down with me and talked to me about it. They also have morning if you're having trouble, for example, if you're, you know, just if your husband's deploying, you know, when he goes, there's counseling for him, there's tons of activities that they have for you to do. And that, you know, that's Army wide. You know, it's not just with ACS, it's with the MWR, which is morale, welfare, and recreation. They put stuff together, and then there's also groups called the FRG. There's a lot of acronyms in the Army, by the way.
Sounds like it, yeah.
The FRG is a family readiness group, and that's a group of wives and, you know, family members who are in the unit that, you know, the soldier is in. So, you know, today, for example, with the FRG and my husband's unit, we all got together at lunch and went bowling for a little while. They do get-togethers, you know, recipe swaps, movie nights, stuff like that, and there's all kinds of stuff available for after he comes back as well. There's coaching on how to deal with the transition when they come back, what to expect, you know, when he comes back, and what to do when he's leaving. A lot of what to expect when they're getting ready to go, because it's a really tough time, and it's really hard to deal with that if you've never experienced it before.
I'm sure. And from what I understand, both of you did not come from military families, so that has to be quite difficult given that you're both are not really familiar with Army culture.
It is difficult. You know, he has an uncle who is in the Navy, and I have an uncle who is in the Navy, but that's about it. So as far as military culture goes, you know, neither of us really knew what we were getting into completely when we went into this. And so dealing with, you know, the transition of going from a civilian life into an Army life was a little difficult at first. It's getting easier now, but at first, you know, dealing with the regulations and the, oh, well, I can't come home tonight because I have to stay because that's what my sergeant told me I have to do. It's like, well, I thought you were coming home for dinner. Well, that's not happening anymore.
Yeah.
And then that's just like, okay, there's nothing I can do about it, but all right.
Yeah, I mean, some people's husbands can't come home because they're busy working late, but, you know, theoretically, you know, they do ultimately return home at the end of the night, but if your sergeant tells you you can't, you really, really can't. It's sort of very, very, very interesting in that regard, and it completely and totally turns the tables on what most people who are in the civilian world know and are familiar with.
Exactly.
So, approximately how long do most tours last for individuals in the Army? Because spouses are separated for quite some period of time.
Yeah, they can get separated anywhere from 6 months to 9 months to 12 months to even up to 18 months. 18-month deployments aren't really as prevalent at the moment because we are winding down with, you know, the war in Afghanistan and the war in Iraq. So, you know, those aren't really happening anymore. Nowadays, it's more 9 to 12-month deployments. But it is a significant period of time, and it's really rough dealing with that back at home because, you know, nowadays, thank goodness, there's a lot more resources for staying in touch. But at the same time, if something goes wrong over there, then you might not hear from them for a couple of days.
Absolutely. And I'm sure those couple of days are horrible. So, absolutely. And so how often are you able to communicate, though, theoretically, when he goes over? Like, every day, Skyping? I mean, I don't know how cell phones really work over there. Are they allowed to have cell phones, or?
They're not allowed to have them, but there's really no point because they don't have any cell phone towers overseas. So you can have the cell phone, but you'll never be able to use it. So a lot of soldiers get rid of their plan when they go overseas. Now, they do have, you know, telephones over there where they can call home. There's computers, there's internet services. You can, you know, Skype home and stuff like that. I'm going to be very fortunate with my husband's deployment. I might be able to talk to him every day, if not maybe twice a day on some occasions. Depending on where they go, you could not hear from your husband for a week, and then all of a sudden, you know, you get a phone call saying, hey, I'm not here, I'm fine, I can't talk long, and that's all you have for another few days. It really depends on what's going on, where they are, what country, and what amenities the base that they're on has.
Well, Hannah, I'm very happy to hear that you and your husband will be able to communicate regularly when he's deployed in the near future.
Oh, yes.
Can I ask you one question? I'd like to just know, what's the one myth that you'd like to dispel for people regarding military marriages?
Let's see. The one myth that I would like to dispel definitely is that, you know, all women should marry men. Well, we all know why she did that. Because it is a myth. Because those people do exist every once in a while, but they're not the main people. You know, they're not the main wives. They're not the main husbands. You know, I've actually never met one. Specifically, we call them, you know, military girlfriends, military wives. You know, we call them dependents. You know, they kind of have this. There's a stigma around being a military dependent because they're like, oh, well, she's only sticking around so that she can have free health care and get the paycheck every month type of thing. That's not the case at all. I mean, for example, with me and my husband, you know, we knew each other beforehand, and so, you know, that had absolutely nothing to do with it. He joined the military at one point, yes, because he wanted to be able to support us if we ever decided to start a family, but that's not why I stuck around.
Of course, and I must say that I don't think that's the conception of, at least I hope, that's not the conception of most people regarding people who serve in our military and their spouses. I'd like to thank you for joining us today, and thank you and your husband for the immense sacrifice that you make and people like you make for our country.
Thank you very much. I was glad to be on.
Thanks. All right, lovers and friends, that was Hannah, a military wife, talking to us about her experience and that of her husband trying to have a marriage together as a military family. I'm going to play a little music and then come back with Dominic Rossetti. Don't go anywhere.
Welcome, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. This week, I've been reading a lot of articles about the Yale policy on rape on campus, and apparently they've sort of redefined how rape can be considered on campus and defined it to be non-consensual sex. So we're going to be talking today with legal expert Dominic Rossetti, and hoping to really dispel some of the rumors and get down to the nitty-gritty. Welcome, Dominic. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you, Jess?
I'm really well, thanks. So, Dominic, I had some questions for you. As I mentioned before, Yale sort of developed this policy where rape can now be classified as non-consensual sex. Can they do this?
Sort of. I mean, what's really going on here is Yale has issued a policy about how to deal with sexual misconduct on campus, and it covers a lot of ground, from anything from a groping situation or a flashing situation all the way to rape. So there's a lot of space that they're covering here, and there's a lot of, like, liability covering that they're trying to do with this document. I mean, it's drafted by a lawyer. It's a fairly sophisticated piece of paper. This is not to say that Yale has real rape perfectly in the past, but most colleges don't. They have sort of competing interests. They want to protect their students. That includes the girls that are been getting sexually abused or misconduct or whatever it may be, but they also want to protect their image at large, so they don't want newspaper headlines flashing around that Yale is charging students willy-nilly with rape. So there's definitely a competing interest here that's, it's hard to grasp exactly what's going on, but you know that it's not law that Yale's issuing, it's just sort of a policy of how to deal with these situations.
Of course. So, Dominic, I want to understand this a bit further and get your advice. Are you saying that Yale can define groping or flashing one's breasts or tush to somebody the same way they can define someone forcing themselves upon someone in a sexual way and assaulting them?
Well, Yale can make policy however it wants to make policy. Right. When you go to a college campus, you have, like, levels of discipline. Right? There's the dean's office, and then there's this sort of internal peer review situation you've got for stuff like plagiarism. But then there's also the law of the state of Connecticut or wherever your college is, that's going to supersede anything that Yale has to say. So a policy pronouncement by the Office of General Counsel, which is all that this thing is, it's just going to dictate the way that Yale internally deals with issues.
Of course.
Which is something that we definitely should be talking about, but it's different. I wouldn't say that they're redefining rape necessarily, because rape is going to be prosecuted the same no matter what Yale's got to say with it.
Yes, no,
but
I was...
whether or not that information gets to the DA and the police is sort of different.
Sure. No, absolutely. So essentially, by defining rape as non-consensual sex, Yale may not necessarily have to report it to the police.
Possibly. That's the sort of issue here, if you were talking about, like, a law school exam where Okay. Something like that. That's the sort of glaring loophole that Yale's got. If they don't really define things right and send things up the ladder in the appropriate way, this is sort of similar, it rings a similar bell to the Joe Paterno, Jerry Sandusky issue, where issues that could have been handled better weren't, and then it just sort of snowballs.
Of course.
So there needs to be a better internal policy, or a more clear internal policy, but it's going to be really difficult for a university to do that because they don't want to put themselves on the headlines, like I said.
Well, unfortunately, now they are, because their policy is unclear, and people are now making a lot of speculations about what's existing and what isn't existing. But
yeah, it's kind of a catch-22.
But one of the interesting things about this is the punishment associated with it. And we talked about, obviously, rape is a crime that's defined by the Connecticut state legislature. But at Yale, non-consensual sex can be punished with a warning. That seems a little bit unreasonable to me. And do you think that Yale's just doing this to try to limit their liability?
I do think, I mean, when you get down to it, the general counsel there, that's their job, is to keep the university looking good, to limit liability and to act as the lawyer for the school. So certainly they're doing this to limit liability, but I don't know if that's a fair characterization to say that rapes are going to be punished with warnings at Yale now because of this policy. There's a whole litany. There's a big list of how these issues are supposed to be dealt with and what kind of punishment can come out of any sexual misconduct, not just non-consensual sex.
Of course.
So, I mean, in theory, it could be punished with a warning. Remains to be seen whether or not that will be the truth, though.
Yes, and also, an interesting point, and I was really curious about this, what is the role of the New Haven police? That's where Yale is located, in New Haven, Connecticut, to our listeners who don't know this. What is their role? Do they have jurisdiction over what happens on the Yale campus?
This was actually fascinating. I didn't know the answer to this question. The Yale police are a real police department.
Oh, wow.
They have guns, they make arrests, they go to the same police academy that any other law enforcement officers. They're sworn officers, is what they're called.
Okay.
Any other law enforcement in Connecticut has the same power as they do. That said, there is some sort of concurrent jurisdiction with the New Haven police and the Yale police. So the Yale police are limited to just the jurisdiction of the school, to the geographical area of the school.
Okay.
New Haven police have the whole area, which includes the school. Practically, when you call 911, it's based on where you are. So, you call 911 at Yale, you're probably going to get a Yale police. There's a chance that you can get a New Haven police, but probably get the Yale police. But either or could respond.
Absolutely. So, I mean, from a practical perspective, I was thinking that if a student at Yale knows that there is a policy that exists that doesn't really have much teeth to it with regards to protecting victims of sexual assault, do you think they would be more likely, or would this make them more likely to call the New Haven police versus the Yale police, because they know that the New Haven police may not necessarily go through Yale with regards to dealing with the investigation?
Are you talking about a victim making a call?
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think that a victim might be more likely if they know that there's not much backbone behind the university in prosecuting individuals who commit sexual assault, might go around the system at Yale and circumvent it completely by trying to contact the police in the city.
Absolutely. I think that's a real possibility when you've got sort of bad policy like this and schools trying to deal with issues internally that shouldn't necessarily be dealt with internally. And I think saying that policies like this have no teeth is a perfect way to describe it. They really are sort of harmless. These kids are not going to get in as much trouble as they should if they were working, if they were, you know, at a firm somewhere. This sort of internal mechanism wouldn't occur.
No, I don't.
There's always ways to circumvent authority, right? There's people filing federal lawsuits. You can call the prosecutor. You can call a different police station that has similar jurisdiction. Try and go federal. There's always another way to get around it. And when you get pressed like this, people are going to try.
Yeah. I mean, I have the utmost respect for Yale as an academic institution, and I'm just surprised that professors and academics there just haven't spoken out. I mean, Yale has one of the largest women's studies and most respected women's studies departments in the country, and I'm just shocked that the chair of the department is not up in arms and waving a flag on CNN, Fox, and MSNBC telling people what a mockery of a policy for sexual assault this is. I mean, it's laughable.
Yeah, I just don't... I don't think we've gotten to quite that level yet. I don't think Yale's conduct has been quite that outrageous. Maybe it has. Maybe I'm wrong. But I don't think it's, I also don't think this is particular to Yale. I think this is going on at colleges all over the country with all sorts of issues.
Yeah, no.
Sex is always very delicate, too. The paternal issue is right along these same lines where just problems are not dealt with, particularly sexual nature, are not dealt with well internally.
Of course.
They are, yeah.
Well, schools have the resources to deal with it, but also victims don't necessarily come forward. You know, it's very difficult to prove the crimes generally. But at the same time, I mean, you know, Yale can define sex or non-consensual sex however they like. My concern is with regards to how it's punished and considered at the university, which obviously is reflected in how they define it. But if a student can just get a warning for sexually assaulting somebody, I just find that to be totally unacceptable.
Yeah, part of the issue is that they're even trying to deal with these things internally. A lot of these issues simply should not be dealt with internally.
Mm-hmm. Got it.
The Sandusky comes to mind. That should have been referred out as immediately as it got to the higher-up's desk.
Absolutely. Absolutely. College Park police should have been notified. Absolutely. So how does this, though, maybe affect liability at Yale generally? You know, would a student be able to sue the university if they didn't feel as though the university appropriately prosecuted or dealt with a student that committed sexual assault?
Sure, that's what these federal lawsuits are about the university's mishandling, about the university having bad policy. Efforts like this, with this document that came out, are intended to avoid that sort of liability later.
Got it.
So if Yale makes it very clear what their policy is now, how they're dealing with it, what the procedure is from the moment that an RA finds out about it until it crosses the president's desk, which basically what this document does is it walks you through exactly what will happen.
Yeah.
When an sexual misconduct happens.
Got it.
That really is an effort for them to limit liability down the line.
Yeah, no, and I mean, given all of these cases that you've mentioned, there's, as you said before, there's this huge class action lawsuit. I think Berkeley and BU are involved in this suit, where students are not very happy with how the university has handled sexual assault on campus. And I think that this is going to be a very large issue. And maybe campuses shouldn't be handling it. I mean, I think that you mentioned that. Maybe this is, you know, a local state issue that needs to be dealt with by the police outside of the university. And after that individual is dealt with through the state system, maybe then the university can step in and take action if they would like to. But I think that the issue of sexual assault is larger than the university, and I don't think necessarily that universities have the resources to combat this issue.
Yeah, I can tell you that in my own experience as an attorney doing criminal defense that sex crimes are a delicate issue. Sex crimes are difficult. It's hard for prosecutors to prove their case. It's hard to talk to victims. The whole process is difficult. Investigation is difficult. Conviction is difficult. Trials are very difficult. People don't want to testify about these things. So this stuff's hard for people who make a living doing it, who call themselves professionals, to foist such a task and responsibility on somebody that's an RA or somebody that doesn't really know about these sorts of things. It is just inviting a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Dominic, thank you so much for being with us today. This was wonderful as always.
Thank you so much, Jess.
That was Dominic Rossetti talking to us about non-consensual sex at Yale University. I'm going to play a little bit of music and then get back with my dating advice for the week. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back, lovers and friends. This is Dr. Jess, and you're listening to Hook Up with Dr. Jess, your show about sex, dating, and relationships from a fun and scientific perspective. We just had Dominic Rossetti, our legal expert, on talking to us about the implications of Yale's non-consensual sex and sexual assault policies. Now we're going to go into my dating advice of the week. So our relationship expert and marriage and family counselor, Jason Harley, posted an interesting article today that I wanted to talk a little bit about to you and give some advice. So there was an article Jason posted today about how parents need to talk to their sons about respecting women in the context of Robin Thicke's song Blurred Lines. And you guys know how much I love the song. At the same time, I think it does raise these issues of how do we perceive women and what are we saying to our children? This article dealt with how parents talk to their sons about women, but I want to talk today about parents talk to their daughters about women. Women, my parents always told me, if you give respect, you get respect. So if you act in a way that is consistent with how you want to be treated, you'll get the respect you want. Namely, that means dress to impress, be kind to others, always, and be a lady. If you act like a lady, you'll be treated like a lady. That's the show for the week. Remember, y'all, don't fake it.